right. Hello, everyone. This is Doug with Emotional Fair Journey, and my wife Linda is here.
Hello.
And we're very happy to be doing this webinar tonight, and we wanted to thank all of you for attending. Tonight we're very happy to have as our guest Jeff Murrah. Jeff is a frequent contributor to our blog and is a marriage and family counselor in Texas with over 25 years of experience, and he's been in private practice since 1994 and has worked in various hospital settings since 1981. He also taught psychology courses at San Jacinto Junior College for 6 years, and he has a website at www.restorethefamily.com and a blog at surviveyourpartnersaffair.com/blog. Jeff is also an author of How to Cope with a Cheating Spouse, and tonight we're going to be discussing some of the points of that book. And after our interview with Jeff, we'll open up the lines for a few questions, and then Jeff. So without further ado, Jeff, you there?
Yes. Thanks for welcoming me here.
Hey, no problem. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Yourself?
Not too bad. Not too bad at all. Thank you. I'd like to thank you, first of all, just for joining us and also for all the great input and advice that you've been adding to our blog. And we do appreciate it very much, and I think many of our readers do as well.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that because I know anything that we can do to improve marriages and families and make them stronger, it helps everyone.
Absolutely. Well, without further ado, let's jump into this a little bit. I know we don't have a lot of time, so let's get rolling here. Both Linda and I read your book, and we found it very to the point, very interesting. And I like that there's really no fluff, and you know, to your book, and there's a lot of great advice. And your workbook with that is also very excellent. We worked through that, and there's a lot of good stuff with that as well. And I know one of the first things that when Linda found out about my emotional affair that I had, that she felt very much out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that many of our readers are feeling that same way after they discover their spouse's affair. And just what are some things that they can do maybe to regain some sort of the control in their life?
Oh, yeah, that's a common problem because it hits so hard. I know when my father had to deal with those issues. He referred to it as Hiroshima, and so you'll find many times people will use these destructive terms as a way to describe it.
Hiroshima, I've not heard that one before.
I think that may be something unique to us. A lot of people refer to it as D-Day or Armageddon, things such as that. These vivid images to describe how your world goes upside down and it's so alien from what it once was.
I got you.
Usually, I recommend 5 things. The first is for people to make a conscious change in their thinking, to go from assuming that it's a crisis to looking at it like it's a problem. There's something about the way that we think that when we're in crisis, we feel like we are out of control, we can't deal with it, and we're helpless. Yet when we start looking at problems as if they are problems, our mind starts trying to find solutions to the problems. So one of the first things to do is mentally change this whole affair situation from looking at it as if it's a crisis to one where it's a problem. Number two, focus on what you need to do. Many times what happens with that sense of being out of control, part of it is that people have lost their sense of focus. They're either looking too far into the future, they're looking into the past, and they're not taking care of what they need to do right now. If you've ever been on a boat, one of the main things that sailors do is take a bearing and find out exactly where they are. Then they can, once they know where they're at and what they need to focus on, it's easier for them to set a course to get to their destination.
Sure.
Number three, to let go of unrealistic expectations. Many times we still have this magical thinking that we want somebody or something to come along, wave a magic wand, and all of a sudden we'll be back in love again, like Prince Charming or Sleeping Beauty and so forth. I mean, I like the Disney movies, but the Disney mindset is something that gets in the way when it comes to counseling. Number four, it's important to find a good support group. And by good support group, this is an area where I often step on people's toes, because good support is not the people that keep you out of pain. Good support is going to be the people that are going to be by your side going through the pain, people that are willing to tell you the truth. Many times when we're hurting, we automatically assume that our the best people for us are those that will get us out of the pain. Those may be some of the worst ones for us.
They're just basically telling you what you want to hear. Is that kind of what they're doing usually?
That's part of it. And part of it, pain is a powerful motivator. There was this one situation that I found myself dealing with. The husband had to leave the home for an extended period of time for his job. And while he was gone, some friends in a local community support group came along, and they started giving the wife all kinds of activities. And so she got her mind off her husband and didn't feel like she needed him. And when he came back, he was blown away to find out that his wife wasn't interested in him anymore, and she was going to divorce him. And many times with your support group, they can get you so much out of pain, you lose any motivation to want to turn around and fix your marriage.
That's interesting.
Okay. And number five, and this will go along with it, it's going to be important to focus on overcoming separateness rather than reducing the pain. With an affair, there's distance in the relationship between the husband and wife, and it's going to be important to look at what's going to decrease that separateness as opposed to what's going to get you out of pain.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question on that?
Oh, sure.
Does that mean that you should, I mean, I'm trying to say, that sometimes when our spouse is having an affair, we want to cling to them and to move closer by becoming more emotional or asking questions? Is that a good thing, or should we back off or pull further away?
Oh, boy, that's a good one. In dealing with that, it's almost like once there's an affair, there gets to be a set amount of distance in the relationship. And one of the weird dynamics that happens, it reminds me of junior high school romances. Mm-hmm. You know, where the boy will chase the girl for a while, then the girl will chase the guy for a while, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. But they still have that same distance. And that same kind of phenomena many times happens in couples where there has been an affair. You know, where one party will chase the other one, and they'll turn around and chase, but you still have that same blasted amount of distance. When you do things like trying to talk to them and the clinginess, focus on things that will draw his heart into it and your heart, as opposed to you just chasing after him.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to find ways of engaging them rather than just chasing them.
And what, can you give us an example of that? How would you engage your spouse?
To engage a person, when we talk to people, we're drawn to individuals that are full of life and full of energy. Nobody is drawn to somebody that is depressed and has nothing to give. We tend to not be drawn to those types of things. And when you ask questions, if you can ask your spouse questions that will engage their heart. Many times the big challenge there is finding a way to get their attention to where they are listening. listening to you with everything that is there. I think on your blog, a lot of times you've talked about the affair fog, and many times finding ways to cut through that is a challenge. The best rule of thumb I can give you on that, to try to engage him but not lose yourself in the process, because so many times the wife will chase after the husband to the point where, you know, she will totally change herself, change the foods that she eats, change the music that she listens to, totally change the way that she dresses. That's going too far.
Right.
And, you know, even if you did get him at those points, you lured him by the accoutrements and everything around you. He's becoming more interested in that than in you. You know, when you want him interested in Linda, you want him interested in Linda, not Linda's high heels, not Linda's dress, Linda.
Or who Linda thought the other person was like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Next question.
You mentioned in your book that after discovering infidelity, it's very important for the victim to ask the cheating spouse questions.
Right.
Can you explain why and cite some examples?
Okay. In my book, a lot of times I'll make reference to asking the right questions. And let me go through and talk about that for a few moments. Some of the common mistakes people make, first of all, they will ask questions that don't have an answer. So it's going to be important that if you ask them a question, that's a question that they can come up with an answer to. Yeah, because right off the bat, they'll start asking, why this, why that, and all kinds of things that the spouse usually doesn't have an answer to, the person who was cheated on doesn't have an answer to. It's almost like those questions come across as whining as opposed to looking for answers. Number two, it's going to be important that the questions are honest. And what I mean by honest questions, nobody likes to be ambushed. And if you tend to be one of those spouses that you ask a series of questions where you lure the cheater into a trap and you're fixing to spring it on them, that's not an honest question. You're not honestly looking for answers there. Number three, use questions that focus on understanding. Because during that time, it's going to be imperative that you look at understanding rather than them agreeing with you. Number four, focus on how and what questions. This is, oftentimes I have to drill this into people. Let go of the why questions. Use how and what questions. And number five, assume responsibility for what you think, what you feel, and what you do. You know, so many times spouses will come out with statements like, you made me feel this way, or you made me feel that way, or how could you leave me feeling like that? These kind of questions, they're great for starting fights, but they're lousy for making some headway. Some examples of these questions. When you sit down with your spouse, to ask him, what's missing from our marriage? See, because that way, with a question like that, you're focused on the relationship. You're not blaming yourself. You're not blaming him. You're saying, okay, what's missing? Another example, what will it take to move past this? You know, once again, you're getting into that problem-solving way of thinking, and you're assuming that the marriage is going to move on. What's it going to take for us to get from, you know, point A to point B? Another one, how are you going to handle this with your parents? How are you going to handle this with the kids? Once again, this is a question. It cuts to the heart of the matter, but it also puts them in a problem-solving mindset without trying to put more guilt and more blame on them. And then also, if you focus on the emotions, you're going to get much further than if you get into the whole idea of proving and disproving what was said and whether or not this happened or that happened, because couples will dance around that for a long time. Okay, the reason for asking questions this way, it's a little awkward because a lot of times when you find out about the affair, you're overwhelmed. But questions are important because they drive the communication. Depending on the questions you ask, the people's attention is going to either go into the past or it's going to move the marriage forward into the future. And why questions tend to push people into the past rather than how and what questions, which are more problem-solving and push you more into the future, more into where you're going to want to go.
That's a hard thing for people to do when you think about it. You know, I think that especially Linda, you know, she wanted to know all the whys and everything like that. And it's just kind of a natural reaction for most people, I think, to want to know that. So that's good stuff that people should learn there, that to try to change their thinking and change their mindset as far as that goes.
It's hard to get out of that because this is one of those we have our natural reactions, and this is counterintuitive, I think, is the term for it. Because if we stick with the natural thing, why? Well, first of all, the cheater many times does not know why at that time. And with a lot of those why questions, it's almost like the person who was cheated on works himself up into a bubble that you can't communicate with them. No matter what you say, it's almost like it's not going to cut through and it's not going to be good enough because they'll hit you with half a dozen other why questions.
I think it also enables us to become the victim.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, and that's not a place we really want to be.
No, it creates a whole new mess of stuff.
Yeah.
You don't want to head on into.
Well, to kind of further along the line that you were going into there in your book, you make it pretty well known there that effective communication is a key element to surviving an affair. Can you kind of go over some of the do's and don'ts with respect to communication?
Sure, no problem. Let me get that and I will go ahead and go through that. Because communication, well, I hate to start off on a negative foot, so let me go ahead and give you one of the positive things to do it first, and then I'll head on into the things what not to do real quick. In terms of the communication, the best thing that you can do is listen. And when you can ask your spouse questions that will help you understand where they're coming from. Now, I use the word understand. That does not mean you agree with what they're saying. It does not mean that you believe what they're saying. You're just trying to understand what they're saying.
Right.
And just with human nature, when someone is intently listening to us, we naturally feel drawn to them. We want to get closer to them. And so listening is one of the key things. Now I'm going to head into a list of some of the things not to do. Then I'll come back to some other things to do to improve.
Okay.
Of course, some of these, once again, are counterintuitive, but what not to do is being persistent in bringing up the affair. When you repeat a message over and over, that's a sure way to be ignored. The way that our brain operates, we tend to ignore things that are repeated. In fact, a fellow by the name of Jack Payton coined the term MIGO, which stands for my eyes glaze over. And, you know, if you're talking to your spouse and bringing it up and all of a sudden their eyes glaze over, they're not there. And
I think Linda's seen me with MIGO.
With the MIGO?
Yeah.
Way too many times.
Oh, yes. Y'all have done that dance a few times.
Sure.
Wanting all the details is a close cousin of that. The danger with the details, details produce very vivid word pictures. And when you know all the details about what the other person looks like, what they were wearing, what you, where you met, what you did, it begins to sound more like letters to the editor in a men's magazine than a couple talking about what they need to talk about. And when you have all those details, it's going to make it that much more difficult to forgive and to get that word picture out of your mind. You know, if one of the places where they met was the Holiday Inn, after you know that, every time you go by the Holiday Inn, you're going to have these negative connotations of the Holiday Inn. That type of stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's also going to be important to avoid making demands. When you're in that fragile period after you find out about the affair, you want to get the two of you committed to one another before you start making demands of the other person. Now, I draw a distinction between demands and between boundaries. People will need to have boundaries, but the demands tend to lead to problems. Another thing is to be closed-minded. If you're going to sit, you know, if you want your spouse to sit down and talk with you, one way to make sure that they don't stay there is to be closed-minded.
Right.
And that includes the whole idea that it's got to be my way, and my version of the events is the only one that counts, and my understanding as to what motivated you is the only thing that counts. That whole my way or the highway gets you in trouble. Number five, not being self-righteous. Now, I know for people that are people of faith, this is a tough one. But this is one that is important because you want to be their spouse. You're not trying to be their pastor. You're not trying to be their Holy Spirit. You're not trying to do that. That's going to change the dynamics of the relationship. But you want to be their spouse. And if they're going to make changes, you want them to do it because of their own conscience, not because you guilt-tripped them into doing it. Number six, infringing on their time and space. You will need to allow them some time and space to get their thoughts together. And many times what happens, the hurt spouse wants things to happen now. They want things to happen real fast. And many times you start doing the right thing, it's almost like you've got to give it time for everything to make changes. I like to use the picture of one of those giant super tankers. They can turn, but it's a slow process. And when you're talking about completely turning a marriage around, it's going to take a little bit of time. They don't turn on a dime. It's going to be important that you do not have an affair for a payback, that you not punish your spouse, and not blow things out of proportion. That's blowing things out of proportion is a sure way, especially if you have any listeners that have teenagers. This applies to them, too. One sure way to make sure your teenager quits listening to you is to freak out and blow things out of proportion. Same thing with spouses. Well, think about it. I mean, when you're a teenager, one reason you don't tell your parents things is because they freak out. And, you know, if you're
exactly.
a spouse that will freak out, they're not going to tell you. Okay, that's on the negative side. Let me get on the positive side and the good things.
Okay, finish up on a positive here.
Okay, to improve communication, it's going to take activity and you taking initiative. Sitting back and being passive is what you want to avoid. By taking initiative, you may have to learn some ways to start communication. You may have to be the one to pick up the phone and call. You may have to be the one to reach out. Now, another one, and this is where I use the action formula, A for activity, C for communication. And since communication is two-way, you're going to need to talk, and you're going to need to let them talk. When one person is doing all the talking, it's nothing more than lecturing. And this is why I mentioned the listening is the key to removing distance. This is part of their communication. T, that stands for time. I, that stands for intimacy. And by intimacy, I'm not talking about just being able to do things in the bedroom with each other. This deals more with rebuilding the emotional oneness and the relationship. A lot of times what happens, people confuse intensity for intimacy. Those are two separate entities. And many times with affairs and that type of stuff, it's there's a lot of excitement and a lot of intensity, and the people who are caught up in that, they think, oh, that means we're intimate. No, it doesn't. It just means that you had an intense time. But in terms of improving the communication as a couple, it's going to be important that you be able to share emotions with one another, not just the anger, but also when you're scared, when you're lonely, when you're happy, these type of things.
Sure.
O stands for objectivity. This is one that's hard for a lot of people because when cheating happens, we take it personally. And it's hard to get out of that personal mindset. But in overcoming it, objectivity is going to be important. It's almost like learning how to look at the events from different perspectives. Once again, doesn't mean you agree with those perspectives, or but being able to develop the flexibility where you can be objective. And the end, the final part, is no museum trips. Many times couples want to, when a cheating happens, it's almost like it opens the door for them to dig through every past wrongdoing that they have done to each other. I mean, they start bringing up how they raised the kids, what happened in their families of origin, and people that they dated even before they were married. You know, everything into the sun, and you need to avoid that. If you're going to heal the marriage, you need to look at what's going on now, what you need to do in the future. Those museum trips get you in trouble.
Museum trips. I like that analogy.
I think I covered most of that there.
Okay. Very good.
In your book, you address the three types of affairs, mean, mythical, and puzzling.
Yes.
Can you give us characteristics of each one of those?
Yes. Okay. Now, in my book, I was quoting an author by the name of, I believe his name was Jay Haley, and he wrote the book where he identified the three types of affairs. Actually, he mentioned four, but three main ones back in 1986, and they were the mean, the mythical, and the puzzling affair. Okay, with the mean affair, this is where the cheater selects someone where the whole affair is nothing more than intentional meanness. This is like having an affair with someone's sister or someone's brother. The episode mentioned in the book, there was a wife who, to alienate the husband, she made it a point of having an affair with each of his friends. So, I mean, who's he going to go to now?
So, in your practice, do you find that type of affair very often?
Not always to that degree. I have seen a milder degree of what I would call the mean affair. Of course, when an affair happens to you, you're going to assume it's the meanest thing under the sun. But
right.
The mean affair are those based on revenge or getting back at someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one that I have seen, like for instance, if the wife grew up in a family and they had, well, being down here in Texas, I'll just use an example that I've seen. They may have some strong feelings about Mexicans, and so the husband purposely goes out and finds someone from that heritage and has an affair with them, knowing it is going to send the spouse over the top.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mean affair.
Looking for a way to end the marriage, really, probably, is what they're looking for there, would you say?
In many ways, it's almost like they don't want to man up and leave the marriage. but by having an affair, the divorce becomes a default. It's almost like it's an emergency exit out of the marriage. Many times with the mean affair, she'll see that. Now, with the puzzling affair, this type of affair is when the person chosen, it doesn't make sense. Like, for instance, if you've got a wife that, you know, on the old Bo Derek 1 through 10 scale, she's up there, you know, a 9, 9.5, or maybe 8.5, and then you turn around and have an affair with a woman who's dumpy, maybe missing some of her teeth, and not very attractive at all.
Uh-huh.
People are scratching their head, and that's an example of the puzzling affair where it doesn't make sense.
Our experience from stories that people have told us on the blog, it seems to be quite a common type of affair. We often hear that, boy, she was uglier than me or fatter than me or whatever. You know, it seems to be quite a common occurrence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so when you see those, you know that the affair was not about the physical attractiveness. There were other issues at work.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting emotional needs or security needs or wanting to be admired or communicated with. There's other factors driving it as opposed to any kind of seduction that went on.
Maybe they just like the same restaurants or something.
Then he also mentioned the mythical affair. The mythical affair, now keep in mind, this came out in 86. This is before the internet and that type of stuff. So virtual affairs is not a term he was familiar with. This is where the husband or the wife, depending on who's cheating, creates the impression that an affair is going on when one may not be going on.
You mean only in the mind of one person?
Right. But they go ahead and they purposely plant seeds that essentially keeps the spouse guessing.
This is for like an attention-getting type of attempt or something?
Well, the example he gave in the book, I'll use that one. A husband, you know, he's been out of town. He comes home, and he and his wife are in the process of getting ready to make love. He says, oh, by the way, when I was out of town, I had lunch with a girl at a restaurant. And because he brought it up right when they're about to be intimate, it changed the mood, number one, but it created the impression that an affair was going on. Now, none was going on, but because of the timing and the way he presented it.
Does he have a fear of intimacy?
That happens many times with these types of puzzling situations, because if you create that, there's usually some sort of secondary gain, and what they're after is secondary. Now, a situation where I did have to deal with that, there was the cheater worked for a company, and they wanted to make someone else in the company look bad, so they purposely manufactured emails to create the impression an affair was going on when none was going on, and essentially did a character assassination in terms of their reputation. Now, in my own experience, I see more types of affairs, and I'll go through that list. It's a little bit longer. I have seen some affairs, and this may sound strange, but based on medical things, many times after brain surgery or major traumas and changes in brain functioning, people lose self-control in that area. This does not happen very much, but I have seen it. Then I have the whole addiction mindset, where I have seen love addicts and sex addicts that go out and have compulsive affairs. Then there's the virtual affair, and I believe many times y'all use the term emotional affair. Now, I've also seen I've got several different labels for it because they're often the same thing. I like using the label the Elvis affair, but this would be the nostalgic or the family tradition affair. In some families, affairs have gone on for generations. You know, it's something granddad did and dad did, and then the husband does, and it's almost like they see nothing wrong with it. That's what's expected of them being a man.
From generation to generation.
Right. And so, you know, when you're trying to get your husband to turn around in that situation and it's that ingrained, it's going to be a different challenge than somebody who was seduced down at the local bar.
Right.
And there also, I would add the accidental affair, because those things have happened. Because I have seen people that have been trapped into affairs. And although we don't want to think about it, there are some individuals out there that do look for unsuspecting people and trap them, whether for lawsuits, for money, or for other types of gain. So I have seen that happen.
Like Rick Pitino, for instance, a recent newsworthy notes there. He apparently that's what happened to him, but that's interesting.
And each one has its own quirks, but so it's hard to say one size fits all when it comes to affairs.
Right. Interesting. Okay. Well, thank you for hitting on those. And one thing, I want to kind of switch gears just a little bit here. One of the main issues that we see on our blog almost every day from emails and comments and the like is the subject of forgiveness. And, you know, it's hard for a lot of people to forgive and move on. We know forgetting is difficult as well, but some of them can't even bring themselves to forgive or even think about forgiving. So can you touch on just like what forgiveness is and what it is not, and then maybe also touch on some of the different stages of forgiveness, if you would?
Oh, sure. In terms of forgiveness, what I mean, but whenever I use the term forgiveness, I'm referring to them emotionally letting go of that desire to pay them back. It's not about saying that what they did was all right. It's not about pardoning them and letting them off the hook. It's more about you purposely letting go of the emotional burden so that you can get on with life. So let me go ahead and start with that. And I think some of the pieces will start to come together as I talk about the different stages of forgiveness.
Okay, sounds good.
When I'm in my counseling office, many times what I do, I have this wooden rhinoceros, and I'll stick that rhinoceros in the middle of the table. And we talk about, you know, how they see the rhinoceros and how I see the rhinoceros. And, you know, because some people are looking at it, looking at the head, some people from the right side, the left side, the back side. And I said, okay, if we think of this rhinoceros as this affair, this issue, the first stage is realizing that there are different ways to look at it. You can look at this problem from different angles. Now, say that that's a stage of forgiveness because many times when people are hurt real bad, they aren't even open to the idea that there are other ways of looking at the situation. You know, it's almost like they say, you can only look at a rhino from the head, and that's it. There's no other perspective. They are so stuck in their mindset. So if they can loosen up and realize there's more than one way to look at it, they're well on their way. Doesn't mean that
that's not an easy thing to do, and I'm sure it takes time as well.
Oh, it does, and that's many times why I use the rhino and use an object lesson, because when you try to explain these ideas, in abstract terms, people get lost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the next stage after you realize that there's more than one way of looking at the rhino, you can look at where the head's in front, the heads are in the back, whatever, is realizing that there is a logic behind what the person did. In this case, the cheater, they had some kind of thinking or some kind of logic behind what they did. They weren't totally crazy. Now, you may not agree with their reasons for what they did. You may see them as being perverted in what they did or totally off base. But it's at least acknowledging that there was some reason and some thinking behind it. Okay, and when a person gets through stage two, you know, so we got them to the point where they realize there's more than one way of looking at the affair, and the second stage, they realize that the person had their reasons for doing what they did. Then, at the third stage, you're at the point, it's going to be a little more riskier, because then you've got to open yourself up to allow the person to make things right. Now, this one gets a little trickier because so many times when we've been hurt, people will tell themselves, there's no way I'm going to let that person ever make it up to me, or there's no way they can ever make this right. And when statements like that are made, mentally it puts a wall up that there's no way that the cheater can ever get past the wall. And in terms of forgiveness, that wall stops things both ways. So at this stage, stage three, the person has to make some conscious efforts to start letting the wall down. I'm not saying that they have to do it all at once. This is one reason why I mentioned that forgiveness is a process. It is not one of these things that on Tuesday you choose to forgive and the slate's clean from then on. No, it's more like on Tuesday you might let it go of 2 ounces of pain and you forgive those 2 ounces and you still have 5 tons that you've got to deal with. And on Wednesday you let go of 2 ounces more. On Thursday you let go of 2 ounces more. So it is a process.
It's also a two-way street. What if the cheater is not willing to make things better? Then what do you do?
When the cheater's not willing to make things better. Well, this gets back to the whole purpose of the forgiveness. The forgiveness is about you letting go of the grudge, because to hold on to a grudge, it takes a lot of energy and time.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not be ready. And this is one reason why I usually advise people not to forgive too soon. Okay. Because if you let go of the pain too soon, it creates problems. One of the things that people have to do is rethink pain and start to look at it as, rather than as something to be avoided, pain is actually a protection of life, and pain actually lets us know what the issues are that need our attention. For instance, when you go to the doctor, one of the questions they ask, where does it hurt? Now, depending upon where it hurts, what kind of pain it is, you know, whether it's an intermittent pain, a sharp pain, a throbbing pain, that gives the doctor clues as to what needs to be done. And likewise with emotional pains, those will give you clues as to what you need to do. And when people forgive too soon, it's almost like they take a painkiller and they've let go of this way to monitor whether or not the issues have been resolved and whether or not the needs have been taken care of. So you don't want to forgive too soon. Now, back to your question, since the forgiveness is about you letting go of the grudge and about you letting go of all the heavy burden that you're under, you can choose to go through the forgiveness process even if they're not asking for the forgiveness, because at this point, you're at least making yourself available that you're willing to sit down and talk and work things through if they're open to it. Mm-hmm. Does that clarify that, or do I need to?
Yeah, it does. I think that, see, a lot of our reader situations is a lot of the spouses are ready to move on and forgive, but they're not getting the what they need from the cheater.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to move on and forget about it. And I think a lot of times we feel that if we forgive, then everything, then we'll be okay, and they'll be okay, and we'll be open up to move on. And I think you do need to see, let your spouse see your pain,
mm-hmm.
and understand what's upsetting you. I think Gardner said that in order for the cheater to realize the implications of what happened, they have to experience as much pain as you experienced. And I think that takes a long time for them to realize how much pain they caused.
Yeah, the pain, I often use the illustration of a seesaw, because the pain will go back and forth between the two of you. When news of the affair comes out, the pain shifts from the cheater to the spouse who was loyal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to go back and forth and back and forth. That's a natural phenomenon that happens when couples start dealing with it. They eventually will have to deal not only with the affair, but also with the pain and where that pain is really coming from. Okay. Step four, the last step, is when you are willing to step back into a relationship with them. Now, when you step back into a relationship with them, you want to do it with both eyes open. At the same time, you know that they have faults and you have faults. And it does take a big risk to step back into the relationship and be willing to work. So the big difference between step three and step four, step three is where you're willing to open the door for them to make things right emotionally. Step four, you take it further because you are actually getting back into a relationship with them and taking the steps to change that.
I think that's the point where you stop walking on eggshells and you have to show the real person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're still going to see their faults. They're going to see yours, and you will always know where you can cut the cord and bring some hurts to the relationship. There are times that you've, even though you see where the faults are, you may choose not to react to them all the time.
Okay. Linda, did you have something to say?
No, I don't. Okay. Should I go on my next question?
Sure.
This is what I find quite interesting. You said that a theory that the affair partner is selected, and how that key to the meaning of the affair.
Oh, boy. Right. Yes. And an affair partner is typically selected, and it does, who they select says a lot about their needs. Now, I have not, being that I'm a clinician, I have not gone out and done the research, and I can't give you the numbers as to how often this happens. But one of the things that really corks a lot of people is that many times it is the spouse who selects who the affair is going to be with. Now, let me walk you through this before you go to work with them now. And what happens, you know, like, for instance, they'll be in the midst of a fight, and one party will say to the other, don't go out and sleep with that sleazy blonde at the office. Or, you know, don't go find your stripper. And the mind does not hear that don't. Instead, it hears, find the stripper, find the bimbo at the office. And it works in the back of the mind. So we've got to be careful what we say.
What we wish for?
Well, and yeah. Think about, like, you've got kids, and when you tell the kids don't do something, what do?
They do it.
Exactly. And many times when we say don't, and when we give them that instruction, we don't realize we're planting seeds. Okay, now let me come back to my caveat. That does not happen in every case. But when I have gone ahead and tested out, it has surprised me and happens with enough occurrence that I needed to go ahead and mention that. Because a lot of times we think that, well, it's just somebody who we met. Well, many times the seeds are planted, and we have to be careful with the seeds that we plant there. But I have also seen cases where a third party turns around and selects the affair partner. In this case, let's say, for instance, the couple's, you know, just rocking along doing their stuff. And let's say one of the mother-in-laws has it in for the husband. And then she starts either starting rumors about the affair or trying to send one of her seductive friends over to catch him alone. These type of things happen. And we have to be aware of it. So the selection is an important thing. And going back to the puzzling affair, when you have somebody that doesn't make sense, that ought to tell you that it's not about physical attractiveness in that case. There are some other needs being met. And when you can decode what those needs are, you know, because if they are providing, you know, reassurances to the spouse, encouragement, making him feel good about himself, maybe they're not being know-it-alls with him, and he enjoys that. And if that's the case, that will give you clues as to what's needed in your marriage. Not that you become like her, but that will help you understand what your husband thinks he needs.
Right. And I think I read somewhere where they said it, when they're describing the other person or describing the relationship,
mm-hmm.
for those words, like Doug used the word fun, and I don't remember what he used, but it's like, I think that's what he was looking for.
I think I lost you there for a second, Linda. Hello? Doug, are you still there?
Yeah, I ran out of battery. I don't know how much you heard, but I think when your partner, your spouse is telling you what they experienced during the affair, for example, Doug said that it was fun and she was easy to talk to, I think those were the things that were missing. And that's
mm-hmm.
why he found it so attractive. And I think as a spouse, you need to really clue in to what your husband or wife is saying about the affair, so then you can understand why what the attraction was.
Right. And this is one reason why I try to emphasize the importance of understanding rather than always agreement. And I know Willard Harley in his book, His Needs, Her Needs, I believe he has a whole list how we need a spouse who is our best friend, who's a playmate, who is a confidant, you know, many qualities all wrapped into one.
Right, right. But they said in that book that oftentimes what the spouse finds important, the other one, their needs are totally different. So you really need to be aware of, you know, just because you feel that you need this doesn't necessarily mean that your spouse needs that also.
Right. And those needs are going to change over time because at
right.
different ages. I know my wife's writing some things down, but somebody had asked about midlife crises and where that fits into affairs. The needs that the couple have will change from decade to decade. And typically when people get near those decade markers, 30, 40, 50, and a year or two on either side, they're going to be more high risk for affairs than at other ages, because at those ages we do a lot of squirrely things. And in order to get our needs met, we are willing to consider some things that we wouldn't typically consider.
Right. So I guess that would be a great time to have a communication with your spouse
to, you know, talk about, you know, what's missing or what you need as you change during those years.
Right. Okay. Any other questions?
Well, we have a lot of other questions, but I think we're getting to the point where we're kind of running out of time here, and we wanted to give some of the people that are on the line an opportunity to maybe ask a few questions of you. So I know we don't have a lot of time to answer a lot of questions, so I apologize in advance if we can't get to them all. But
okay, well, let me go through some of these that I'm aware of here. One person asked, my anniversary is coming up next week. My husband and I live together. He's on the couch. I want to give him a gift, but is it wise to pursue such an occasion when he isn't sure he wants to stay married? One of the things, whether or not the two of you stay married or whether or not a couple stays married, they're going to find they're still going to have to deal with each other. In my book, I point out that a divorce doesn't solve anything. It just changes the battlefield. And when you're talking about taking steps to improve the relationship, many times if this is the husband or the mother, the father or mother of your children, you're still going to have to be dealing with them. And with that in mind, if you're planning on continuing in a relationship with him, the idea of the gift would be good because you're still going to have to deal with him whether or not you stay together or not. Okay, another one. My husband is away for training and had an emotional affair with a woman he went through training with through hours of text every night. He's still not home and things have gotten worse. What can you recommend we do until he gets home? He makes promises and says he's going to make changes, but he doesn't, and says he doesn't know why he's trying, but he just knows that he wants to be with me. Let me parse this one down. Some of it I'll be able to deal with here, and some of it's going to take a little longer. One of the things, many times when cheaters have affairs, they are not about consciously choosing to boot the other spouse out and replace it with someone else. Many times they want to have their marriage and they want to have the affair too. So it's when he says things that he wants to be with you, he probably is telling you the truth. Now, in terms of the promises, where he says he's going to make changes and doesn't do them, this is one of the things that I do talk about in my book, that when couples get back together, it's important to take a look at the promises and make sure you follow through on the promises. I know in his case he is not, and you can talk to him about how disappointing it is to believe in him and then he lets you down. Many husbands want their wives to believe in them. They want their wives to respect, and when you let them know that you feel disappointed, once again, this gets back to dealing with that emotional piece. You let him know that you feel disappointed as opposed to attacking him by saying, you never keep your promises, you're untrustworthy. Those are labels that are going to stir up fights as opposed to being able to work on things. Let's see, another one. My husband wants to work on our marriage, but the other woman is still working with him. What can I do? He says he is sorry, and then he says that he didn't do anything. Where does this put us? That's one of those situations where you need to get some boundaries in place. And one of the things I talk about in the book, once there has been an affair, the foundation of the marriage needs to change. In the marriage before an affair happens, everything's based on trust. You know, you can say, do this or trust me, and you trust them. Once an affair happens, whether it be an emotional affair or an actual affair, it's going to be important that you have communication. You can't just give a person a blank check because you trust them anymore. They've got to show that they are trustworthy. And one way to show that they are trustworthy is to make sure that he tells you when he has interactions with this woman. He stays in touch with you either by text or emails to let you know what happens when he has interactions with her. And over time, as he continues communicating with you, that will give you more solid basis to have some trust develop. I use this formula for trust where the components are communication plus honesty plus commitment plus time. Each of those are important to reestablishing any kind of trust. You've got to have the openness and the ability to talk. You've got to have the honesty where you can believe what the person is telling you, because there's some people they can talk up a storm, but you can't believe them. You've got to have that sense of commitment where they are committed to you, you are committed to them, and given time, much like interest accrues at a bank, a trust will begin to once again develop. Okay, I've got time for one more here. How do you handle emotional affair? Nothing physical, she says, just friends. She sees nothing wrong with the friendship with another man and is not willing to discuss it. One of the things that's becoming a hot topic these days is the emotional affairs, and especially with Facebook. Facebook has opened a can of worms, and how should we say, it has almost single-handedly brought back all kinds of dead boyfriends and girlfriends back to life. And that is a danger that a lot of couples are finding themselves having to deal with, because as you bring these people back into your life, the connections that you made in your brain years ago are reactivated and turned on. It's almost like the light switches, they still work. And she may not see anything wrong with it. This is one you can start by talking to her about your emotions, how it leaves you feeling insecure and that you're afraid that she may step over the line, and that you need a reassurance that you're still important to her. And, you know, that as a husband, it would mean a lot to you if she went ahead and took the step and saw to it that you didn't keep that friendship. Now, I have seen some couples that I've had to work with where, you know, like, for instance, the wife wants to have all kinds of friends on Facebook, but they had to develop an agreement that she could only have the friends that the husband approved of, or in some cases it's vice versa, as a way to police each other's. And you may have to do something kind of like that. One of the crises that couples usually go through when they first get married, they go through a period of time where you have to weed out the friends that are not good for the two of you. And nowadays, rather than that just be a crisis that we only deal with when we first get married with Facebook, we're having to do it almost on a daily basis. So that is a very real threat. I wish I could have gone more in depth. There's so much ground to cover, and the hurts are so intense, it's hard to get to everything. And Linda, it was a joy to finally meet y'all.
Yeah, thank you.
There's
the y'all. I haven't heard the Texas twang all day, and I finally heard the y'all. So I appreciate everything you do, Jeff, and I appreciate you, you know, helping us out on the blog with some of the questions that people have. I know we deal more with it through experience, and you've got the maybe the reasons behind the experience with your professionalism and everything. So we appreciate it a lot, and thank you for all the listeners for attending, and thanks for coming to our blog, and I guess we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Well, thank you, and I thank you all for the work that you do, because in tackling this problem, it takes everyone, those that have gone through it, because no one can comfort us like somebody who can put their arm around us and say, I've been there. I know what you're feeling. So
right.
What you two are doing is very important. And one of the things that blows my mind is how big an outreach that y'all have. I've had a chance to interact with some of the folks from countries on the other side of the Pacific and so forth. Whatever happened years ago in your home, it's bringing healing to people throughout the world. So thank you.
I appreciate that. Well, thank you very much again, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Okay, bye.